Hallo und willkommen zu unserem dritten und letzten Interview mit britischen Filmschaffenden. Am Mikro sind für euch Patrick
und Verena. In dieser Folge sprechen wir mit dem Regisseur Philip John, der euch einen Einblick in die walisische Unterhaltungsindustrie gibt. Philip John hat unter anderem in Folgen von Downton Abbey, Outlander und Marvel's Iron Fist sowie zahlreichen Independent-Filmen Regie geführt. Doch nicht nur seine Arbeit ist international bekannt, er ist auch selbst schon mit unserer Region vertraut und war mit seinem Film Moondogs 2016 beim Internationalen Filmfestival Mannheim-Heidelberg vertreten.
Er berichtet davon, was ihn zu seinen anfänglichen Kurzfilmen inspiriert hat, unter anderem wie er durch Ereignisse, die ihm selbst widerfahren sind, beeinflusst wurde. Zusätzlich geht er darauf ein, wie ihn Musik in seinem filmischen Schaffen leitet. Außerdem erzählt er von der walisischen Unterhaltungsindustrie im Lockdown und darüber, wie Wales in Film und Fernsehen dargestellt wird. Und wie bei unseren vorherigen Gästen reden wir auch über die Unterschiede zwischen den Arbeitsprozessen im Vereinigten Königreich und den USA.
Und zuletzt sprechen Patrick und ich dann nochmal darüber, was wir aus diesem spannenden Interview alles so mitgenommen haben und was Philip Johns nächstes großes Projekt ist, das euch sicherlich auch sehr interessieren wird. Und wünschen euch jetzt auf jeden Fall erstmal ganz viel Spaß beim Zuhören. So, among other works, you wrote and directed some short films like Sister Lulu and Suckerfish, which was also BAFTA nominated. And yeah, I think they were really pretty amazing and really darkly hilarious. So, do you have specific sources of inspiration with each film project that you tackle?
Yeah, Suckerfish, I'm ashamed to say, is a true story. It was my wife's 30th birthday, and I had to do something radical and no clue what, until we went in to see a film with Hollywood actress Meg Ryan, and I came out saying, oh God, I hate Meg Ryan, she's terrible. And my wife said, well, I wouldn't kick her out of bed. So hence the idea was born. You'd have to see the film to know what I'm talking about. But yeah, it was the best £600 I ever spent. And I applied to a local film board who, they liked the script, but they didn't think it was ready. And then I got myself a female producer who said, because what I'd done was written the male side of it. She said you should write the female side of it and just run them side by side, which was the absolute key to making it work. So yeah, I was very lucky to meet that producer, and then we made that. And then did very well. And it got me onto this thing called New Directions, which was a UK scheme to take new directors out to the States. You go to New York and you go to LA for a week a piece, and you show your films and you meet studio heads. And before I left, I thought, right, I'm going to get myself an agent now. Because my theory is that you make a great short film and then you get an agent. As long as you win something with the short film, that's your route in. You don't work for years as a runner and then you go up another step and another step. You just invent yourself as a writer-director from the very beginning. So I figured, right, I'm going to make a couple of short films and I hope they win some prizes. So Suckerfish got chosen for me to go on this trip. But I'd also made Sister Lulu, which I have no idea where that came from. It just came to me, the idea of a woman in a box with a Welsh accent flicking on a Zippo lighter and then discovering that she's in a coffin. Seemed like a brilliant place to start. And so I wrote it around that idea. And I sent that off to ICM, who were a massive agency. I targeted one of the agents and sent the film off. And then when I got back from the States, thinking that this was really going to help me in my career, I just got a flat refusal from the agent I'd send it to. So I thought, oh no. And then I got a call from Kathy, who is my current agent, who loved Sister Lulu. She loved the humor of it and the darkness of it. And so she's been my agent for 20 something years now. It's like a marriage. And I could never do without her. She's been amazing. But my theory still holds. So you make a good film and you get an award and you'll get yourself an agent. If it's a good film, then, you know, it'll catch somebody's eye.
Yeah, really amazing to hear how these things sometimes work out.
Weird, isn't it? It's weird. You think you can plan your life, but it's impossible because something will happen that was completely out of left field that you had no idea about. So yeah, planning is pointless.
That's a good takeaway.
Yeah, truly unpredictable in that sense. Since we are also already on the topic of pure inspiration, I think you also mentioned about Sister Lulu once that it was based on a dream you had once, something that just popped in your head randomly once and that you ran with the idea that you just said.
Yeah, it was just an image popped in my head. And then I just thought, I really like this. I don't know where it's got, there was something. She sort of zipped the Zippo lighter. The light came on. She's in a box. Then she starts laughing hysterically. And I thought, oh God, what's happened to her? And why is she there? And
like a seed that just grew into a plant, I guess.
Yeah. It just grew out of nothing, which is amazing. You know, I don't normally work like that. I normally work from an experiential angle, you know, like I've just written a film about my dad and, that's a lot about his experience as a person and traveling, and you know, it's weird. Perhaps I'm not imaginative enough to really fly off into the realms of, you know, different realms of like darkness. And I sort of have to start from a basis of reality and then the feeling of that, and see how that goes.
Yeah, great how inspiration works in that way. And talking about based in reality, most of your projects use very distinguished music, which I imagine is also pretty inspirational in your work. So do you like playing certain songs as inspiration while writing or prepping a movie? And if so, what makes these songs specifically or music in general important to you? And what role does it play in your work process?
Music is just completely central to me. I was in a band when I was about 17, 16, 17. And it sort of saved my life. I had a university place studying animal psychology, which was nothing to do with what I was interested in. And my parents were expecting me to go, and I was like, I can't go, I'm not going. So I was with my band, and we moved to Cardiff, and we started a record label. And just always into music, always into the bass, I'm the bassist. And then it sort of got me back into thinking about being a director. And so consequently, everything I think about in terms of ideas, there's a music palette for it. And if there's a couple of shows I've done where I'm sent the script and I read it and I walk around, and then suddenly a song will come from somewhere that I've got, you know, in my collection. And I start to think about that song as the tone of the show. So it's very difficult to explain what it is, but one of the shows I did, the song I came up with, which is what I heard at a record shop the moment I knew I got the job. I walked into this record shop and this song was playing. I thought, oh my God, that's it. That's the theme for this thing. So it's kind of weird that when you're out and about and you're open-minded to things will come in and they just sort of feed you. And so consequently now I worked a lot with Anton Newcomb of the Brian Jonestown Massacre. I love his music. He did the music for my film Moondogs. Very lucky to hook up with him, and he's currently doing the music for this detective series in Scotland. Alabama 3, I did a very dark noir series in Wales, and the Alabama 3 are like a UK funk blues electronic band, and the singer is from Wales, and so I invited him to come and do the music for that. And it's interesting going to people who are musicians, because it's like hitting the mother load. You know, you composers often can give you really good copies of something. I don't want copies. I want an actual unique voice. And that's what musicians have. So Anton's music, I listen to all the time, you know, and it's very easy for me to think of a song of his that I could put somewhere on something I wanted to do, because I love all of it. It's, you know, you can't say that about a lot of other bands. You know, I just they don't exist in my head. So there's a kind of palette that, a type of song that I love. And so they really inform things, you know, they really sort of set things up in my head. And then, in fact, I did an Irvin Welsh, Dean Kavanagh film called Wedding Bells. And I gave to all the actors, I made little CDs of all the songs they might like. And I asked each one of them, look, just choose one song and tell me what the story behind the song is, why you like it or why it upsets you or why it makes you, you know, excited. So they all went off and with these CDs, and they chose one song. And then at a certain point in the film, and I'd say, you know that song? What was the thing behind that song? And then they tell a story about that, and it seemed to feed back into the drama. It was really, really interesting. People's relationship with music is very intuitive and sort of sensual and emotional. It's like a really basic language, you know, that we all share.
Absolutely. It's also, as you just hinted at, it's a very reciprocal relationship, because it also gives something to you and you give something back to the music when you play it into your own creative work. So yeah, really interesting how that works out and how it's a two-way street in terms of inspiration.
Yeah. And it always feeds you back something. You know, a composer will do something and it's really, you know, really well worked out. It's odd. It's like there's two acting traditions, right? There's the US acting tradition, which is about sense memory and method, and no two performances are the same. In the UK, there's a theatrical position, which is, it's so you construct a performance and you do the same thing every time. That's like a composer to me. I think composers construct moments, beats, the thing that feeds the drama, that spoon feeds an audience. I don't like spoon feeding audiences with music. Whereas I think using musicians is like going the other way, like the method, like the US route, where you have no clue what's going to come out. And you don't care whether the music actually feeds the emotional story, because it shouldn't be. You know, there's something about slapping music like cheap carpet on a film that somehow feels wrong, because you want someone to feel sad, so you put sad music.
Yeah. Yeah,
you want someone to be excited, so you put thrash metal. You know, it's kind of, I don't know. It's a very personal thing, music, and how you use it. So, but yeah, that's my truth about it, is that I find it really instinctive and intuitive.
Thank you for that insight. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty cool to see how, I mean, it's probably a very difficult tightrope to walk, to making a needle drop in the film, not too, as you just mentioned, not too obvious, like some of these old Vietnam movies that always play the same three songs in a film where you just can't guess which one it is. But then again, if it hits the emotional beat you want, it works.
Why not?
Yeah. And since we're already talking about those different kinds of media, I think that works well for Verena's next question.
Since you also directed in very prominent TV shows like Being Human, Outlander, and Downton Abbey, which I think many of our listeners will know, what would you say are some important differences between TV and film when it comes to creative control, or challenges or limitations that you face as a director?
I think television is a writer's medium. Writers tend to control television much more. You have showrunners. You have people who are there to control the tone and make sure that what you're delivering is what they're expecting. Like for example, I did a Marvel show. It was Iron Fist. And the first day I got there, there were three execs just circling me saying, are you going to storyboard this sequence? Because that's really important. And also, this is a reboot. This is the second season of Iron Fist. It has to work. You know, what are your plans? What are you doing? What are you thinking about that? And it's, they like get inside your head. And that's the kind of the simplest version of what writer's power is in television, is that they are surrounding you and wanting you to deliver the right tone at the right time. And it's interesting then, because you have to work really hard to get your stamp on it, you know, to put what you think is a good idea into it. And I like that, you know, I like the fact that you only get 8 days prep in the US for a 1 hour show. In the UK, we get 6 weeks. And then when you film a US show, you get like 9 days. And in the UK, we have something like 12. And then the edit, you get 4 days in the US and it's 6 weeks in the UK. So it's a very different animal, you know, but it's all run by the writers, because you do your edit and you hand it over in 4 days, and then they take it away and they do what they want with it. But you get paid so much money that it's fine. It's like, okay.
Makes some sacrifices.
That's fine. Yeah. So I think that film is much more It's much more director's medium because it's something about, you know, a single project. It's like there's a vision for it, or there's a story, or there's a tone to it that a director has to deliver. And I think writers, obviously, you know, great writers of screenplays know how to tell a story with pictures. So it's not like they're not capable of running the show. They are. And I think if you have a great relationship with a writer as a director, then I think it can work hand in hand, you know. But generally, you just don't want to hear the writer at all. So that's why I try to write my own stuff. So I don't have that trouble. But I work a lot with Dean Kavanagh and Irvin Welsh, who wrote Trainspotting, and I've done several projects with them. And there's a worldview there that we share. You know, it's very bleak and dark and funny. And so, you know, there's a kind of union there that you enjoy working with. So it's not to say that a director wants to go out on their own and try and find something to write and just think about it themselves. I think it's always a team game. You know, I think even scripts I write myself, you know, I would expect a producer to come on board and say something and change them if they have good ideas. You know, I think it's very much a team game. I hate the idea of film by Philip John. You know, there's so many people involved that it doesn't seem like a fair credit. But yeah, I think it's the writer runs TV, and I think a director has a bit more say in cinema.
Yeah, that's very clear. Thank you for that.
Yeah, that's also good. I mean, it should be a given, but I think even within the industry, people sometimes forget how to play in a team, from the stuff that I've been trying to read up on, may experience that might have gone badly, but it's good that you have that view of being in a team of many talented artists who have to...
Yeah, you choose your team, you know, you choose your crew, you choose your DOP, your designer, a musician, what, you know, you choose all of those people and they all contribute, and yet they need to feel, I mean, you know, it's a benign dictatorship. Do you know what I mean? That's what they say. You know, I'm in charge, but I'm very happy for people to come in and take ownership of this or that. If they've got great ideas, let's put them in. You know, I think it's not about the director. When I say the director is the person who pushes the script, a film script, I still don't think it's about the director. I think it's about enabling people around you to do their best work, like actors, you know, allowing them to do their work, and costume designers. You know, you're there to enable people and sort of give decisions about things, but ultimately I think you get more out of people if they feel invested. And if I'm shouting and screaming like an idiot, that's when you kill it, you know.
Yeah, good ways to contribute and to collaborate in that way. So speaking about the projects with maybe not a benign dictatorship, but about the project that you led and that was very personal, I assume, Moondogs, your second feature film after Wedding Bells, which you just mentioned, was played actually at our regional film festival almost more than 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So how did you like the premiere? How did it feel like for you to have an international premiere of a movie that you worked on? And just for our listeners, maybe, how did you like it in our region at the International Film Festival in Mannheim, Heidelberg?
It made me cry. I was so happy. We filled the house three times, I think. It was a gigantic tent, and just people came and came and came. And I think about my local cinema in Cardiff in Wales, and we had about 14 people turn up. Whereas in Mannheim, we had hundreds and hundreds of people every night. And the film guy stepped up on stage and said, why are all you people here watching this film? What are you doing? And they were just like smiling. It was so happy. And I was there with one of the stars of the film, Tara. And we just could not believe it. You know, we were just kind of so welcoming, so kind of inclusive, and made us feel so welcome, you know, especially after all this Brexit bullshit. You know, you just felt like Europe was a group of nations that should be working together. But now.
Yeah, it feels all the more important right now. Like culture is like a bridge, I think, in some ways that can still buffer this, all this
yes,
political
we have
change.
Fight right these now. Urges, these xenophobic urges of the Brits, of the UK, to cut everybody else out. It's appalling. We are just going down the toilet without you. So,
Back then, I mean, that was in 2016 when the film premiered over here. And I actually attended one of the premieres that I told you about. Just recently, I found a very blurry amateur picture on my phone when I photographed you and Tara Lee sitting on the podium and doing the Q&A back then. So, and already then you were talking about Brexit because that was when it was still fresh.
It's shocking. It's shocking. It's going to be shocking for decades. Yeah. We're very sad about it. Most right-thinking people are sad about it. But yeah, we must keep these partnerships. I'm going to bring another film back to Mannheim if I can, if I'm allowed, if I need a visa or whatever.
Fingers crossed, one day we'll be able to put something like that together, which probably leads us to our slightly darker, maybe less humorous, but more present chapter about during COVID.
We're interested in the process of the entertainment industry in different countries. And what was the Welsh entertainment industry like during lockdown? Do you think it sort of differed from other countries?
I think we were very cautious in Wales, and I think there was a lot of early lockdowns. And I think the people in Wales accepted it because they realized it was the right thing to do. I think we're still very cautious, but we're starting to open up now. And the industry is picking up and jobs are starting up again. Projects are picking up from when they left off. So I think there's a lot of drive to get things moving. And there's a lot of people vaccinated in Wales at the moment. So we've been very successful, I think, at how cautious we've been about the virus. And I'm just doing this thing in Scotland where in order to speak to an actor, I have to wear an eye shield and I have to wear a mask. And it's also freezing cold, so I've got a massive coat on. And then I've got a walkie-talkie and I've got headphones. I'm like a walking avalanche. You know, you can't go near an actor unless you're covered. And then there's condensation on the eye shield, so you can't really see anything. It was incredibly difficult to work like that. I'm about to start work on a project in Sri Lanka, and I'm not quite sure what their lockdown is like. But if I have to wear a mask and an eye shield, I will die. I will die of heat stroke. So I'm hoping things will loosen up and open up. But yeah, it was an incredibly busy year for me, though, the lockdown, because I got a commission to write a screenplay from a book. And then I got this job in Scotland. So I haven't really stopped, you know. And I'm still not stopping. So yeah, I think I've been very lucky. We had COVID as a family. My son goes to school and his mates have got COVID. And so we got a letter back saying that they thought that he may have had contact. So we all got tested and we all had it. And we didn't know. We had no idea. It's bizarre. It's such a weird disease that attacks some people so violently and other people. We had no clue.
Still, congratulations and good for you that you had mild symptoms and all came out okay.
Yeah. No, it could have been a lot worse, you know. It's so difficult. And unless everybody in the world is vaccinated, then nothing will ever be fixed. So everybody, we need to spread this vaccine around. You know, the UK has got way too many doses of vaccine. Send it somewhere. Let's get everybody vaccinated, surely.
Yeah, I mean, partnerships and unions, important, as you said. We'll see if you can finally benefit from your island status if everybody gets vaccinated. We'll see how it's going to be handled.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, Cardiff is also always a big filming location, also for productions like Sherlock or Doctor Who. Mm. And maybe you could tell us something about in what ways this was affected, or could they still film there?
I think a lot of productions stopped. There's a lot of international productions coming to Wales. You know, because we've got great infrastructure and we've got all, you know, edit suites and we've got all of those things that support the film industry. But then for a long time, everything stopped. Everything it became very quiet. And now there's a massive studio, it's called Bad Wolf, and they do His Dark Materials. And they've got an amazing setup there, you know, a massive studio, but they've also got like a training arm where they bring young people in, 16, 17, 18, who have an interest in the industry. And I think they've tried to keep going either through Zoom or classes online. And it's a wonderful thing because it gives access to young people. You know, when I was trying to get into the film business, I had no clue who to talk to or what to do. And suddenly, you know, and I was a working class, you know, we had no money. And so now you've got a lot of working class kids coming out of school and they can get into these training academy places. And then they get placements on film sets and they go in and they try to figure out what it is they want to do. So all of that is opening up again now, and all of that activity is opening up again now. So it's really positive. It's really sort of exciting. And I often bring trainees onto my set, you know, so they can stand around and figure out what they like. Do they like cameras? Do they want to do costume? Like, I remember we had two film students who came on set all day. They just stood there looking incredibly bored. And then at about 3 o'clock, they came up and said, so is there any other way we can help you? I was like, no. No, you completely wasted a day. Why don't you go home?
These guys are probably not going to stay in that same industry.
I don't think so. You know, it's a brilliant opportunity just to get in there and try things, look at things, see how things work. And they just blew it.
Yeah, too bad, but I guess it happens sometimes. Yeah. Speaking about Wales again, personally, I've been there twice, once to the Snowdonia Mountains and once to Cardiff, so to pretty much the north and the south pole of the country, if you can call it that. Yeah. And then again, I feel like especially British or especially English shows still have that classical image of Wales as something very rural with mountains and mines and things like that. And you already mentioned your noir thriller that you directed in Wales called Bang. It's sadly not that accessible in Germany, but it's still available to look up. And it's actually pretty urban from what I could gather. So how important is it for you to break stereotypes about your country in that way?
Absolutely fundamental to me that we break stereotypes. It's absolutely fundamental to me that we try to push Wales abroad. Bang was a kind of very dark, we've done two seasons of it now. It was a very dark show set in Port Talbot. Port Talbot is an amazing steel town. So you've got a gigantic steelworks. And then there's a beach where people surf. So you've got this already idiosyncratic look where you've got surfers and then behind it billowing clouds of steam. And then you've got a very big working class community and then it's surrounded by hills. And so it was fantastic for landscape and also to put drama in those little terraced houses. You know, it was just ideal for us, and the town itself began to have some civic pride. You know, they were like, oh, you're coming here to film something, and we're like, look at it, how beautiful it is. You know, so all of those things feed into a town, and all the finance we bring. You know, all the food we eat, all the actors we support. You know, when a film comes into town, then there's tons of cash being splashed around. So it's always good for that place. You know. So it feels like you're supporting a community, but you're also spreading a story, you know, a noir story with a very Welsh sensibility, because it's all about architecture and kids and problems. And so I find that really important. You know, I've got a film coming up with Anthony Hopkins, and it's about, it's called Let There Be Rock. And it was my first pitch in Hollywood. And I pitched it to this guy who ended up jumping up and down on his sofa saying that we're going to make $1 billion. And it's a fantastic story about a choir. Wales is always seen, you know, it's all about choirs and Welsh people being salt of the earth and da, da, da. But it's about a choir that's dying. All these guys are dying of industrial diseases. And the choir master, played by Anthony Hopkins, is also the local magistrate. And there's this group of young kids in the village who get all their gear nicked by the local gangster who runs a pawn shop. So they go off and try to nick back their gear. They get arrested and they're hauled up in front of the choir master, who says, right, you can go to jail or you can join the choir. And they're like, no way. I go, well, go to jail. So then they decide to join the choir. So there's this lovely story about men at the end of their lives and boys at the beginning of theirs. And they have to get together and they have to make it work. And they have to find things in common that bring them together. And the choir and the voice and the singing, it's just this, and they end up, the choir ends up singing AC/DC numbers.
I was just going to say the title is an AC/DC reference, right? So music again bled into your work very heavily.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But it's written by Irvin and Dean, so it's dark and funny. You know, it doesn't play all of these cliches of Welsh countryside and sheep and all of that boring rubbish, you know. So that would be, it's also a really big film. So it'll be one of those films that will travel and hopefully people will learn a bit more about Wales. And want to visit. And so there, I've definitely got a Welsh agenda. I'm not quite sure why, perhaps I'm getting older.
Sounds really exciting, definitely.
Yeah, it's very exciting. It's very exciting. We were supposed to film 2 years ago, but then something happened and Anthony Hopkins, our money fell out. And just as we were hiring crew as well, it's just so flaky film. So Mr. Hopkins is still attached, so hopefully we'll do it. Probably not this year, but next year.
Crossing our fingers, that sounds like a great pitch and a great actor.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. He's just dynamite. I love him.
Since you already touched upon that earlier, you've worked intensely in both the UK and the US. For example, you also did some Marvel shows like Cloak and Dagger and Iron Fist. And yeah, again, maybe just what would you say are some key difference in the work process of a director between Britain and America?
It's very difficult because first of all, you have to get an O-1 visa. And an O-1 visa, it's kind of like it's called the genius visa. But it costs about $6,000 and you have to assemble every piece of paper that's ever been written about you, every bit of editorial, every review of anything you've made. And I was for months, you're scrolling through the net trying to find some scrap of something about something you did. And eventually I had a pile, you know, but it was so difficult. And the lawyers in the States, they've got you over a barrel. So they're taking money off you left, right, and center saying, oh, we need more stuff. Oh, you need to do this now. Oh, you need to bind it all up. All of it, this costs money. And then you have to wait very nervously to see if, you know, you get the O-1. And the process of it probably took me about a year and a half because I ran out of money after I'd started it. So I had to put it on hold and then go back to it. But then I got it. And I was very lucky, really. I did, because one of the Marvel jobs, the only reason I got it was because a director fell out because they didn't have the right O-1 visa. So then I had to send mine in. I had to wait for like 2 days. Oh God, is my O-1 okay? You know, and it came back fine. So yeah, I got the job. So they do pay for themselves, you know, once you get an O-1. But it's, and I've just now recently, just before lockdown, got another O-1. So I don't know whether I've lost a year of that visa now. Another $6,000, but I don't know. But that's the tricky thing, because then once you start working in the UK, there in the US, there are tax issues and there are, you know, agents and managers and lawyer, all of whom have to get commission. I mean, fortunately, you get paid a lot more there, so it sort of makes sense. But yeah, it's a completely different industry. It's much more ruthless and fast, and you really have to be on your game. Because you will be tested, you know, on every level. I think for the first time, when I went in to do Iron Fist, I was so pestered every day by executives asking me if I'd done this or that. I arrived on set for the first day of filming, and I thought, I can't do this. I think I've forgotten how to do it. I don't think I can get my head around this. And they gave me a 10-page day, which is quite a lot. Normally, you know, you get like 6 or 7, but this is a 10-page day, and we finished early. So I came out thinking, oh, that's fine. And then the next day, another 10-page day, I finished early again. And then the showrunner came up to me and said, oh, your stuff is fantastic. I'm going back to LA. And it was that moment was just like, oh, thank God. Because I really began to doubt, because they were always questioning, always asking me, why wasn't I thinking about this? What was I doing? Am I going to storyboard this? So they're always hounding you. And if people are hounding you, you can't think straight. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that sounds like dinner with my mom.
Yeah. Are they fast dinners? You eat very quickly and then go.
Kind of like that.
Yeah, glad you came out the other end. It sounds like two very different working processes in terms of the countries and a lot of bureaucratic stuff, but
yes,
fingers crossed for your visa for next time.
Yeah, well, I hope I can still use the one I got. So we'll see, you know, if there's a job offer. I mean, it's still closed down over there, so I'm looking at work in the UK and, you know, Europe for the time being.
Yeah, sounds like a plan as well. I mean, you're experienced in that also very much. But considering that, that's what we also ask all our guests. Many plans and many projects, of course, had to be put on hold this last year due to COVID or canceled completely. And you already touched upon your on-set experience on your other show. I think it's called Annika, isn't it? That's what it's
IMDb
with Nicola Walker. Yeah. So that's probably a negative consequence in there because it makes everything more difficult. Do you think there have been also chances due to the crisis in terms of work or anything that didn't come up before the whole COVID disaster?
Yeah, I got sent a script in the December before lockdown. And it was based upon a novel called Arrangements of Love. And I read the script and it was terrible. It was like it's a story about a man who travels from America to find his dad in India because he wants to put a play on. And they're all kind of middle class and rich, and you just didn't care about any of them really. And it was written as a sort of like a Raymond Chandler thing. And I read it and I didn't like it, so I sent it back and said, thanks very much, but not interested. Then about a month later, they came back and said, we agree with all your notes. You know, would you read the novel? And so I read the novel, and it was actually, there was a great story in there. And and they asked me if I wanted to adapt the novel. So just in March, when everything went into lockdown, I got this job adapting this novel as a screenplay. So I did that all through the summer, sat in my shed in my garden, writing. My kids are in the house getting homeschooled by my wife, and I'm there just writing away. And so that it was that, you know, I'm not sure I would have had that amount of time in order to write without the lockdown. So it was, timing never works for me ever. There's always something that comes up and then something else comes up and then something else. This was just like very clear, you know, commission, do the thing, go into lockdown, do it for 6 months. Kept us afloat. It was amazing. Yeah. So yeah, I'm very, very grateful, really. It's the lack of planning again. You know, don't bother planning. Just hope that the universe answers your pleas.
Go straight for the biscuits and see what you find on the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. And so maybe with that notion, we can also look a little bit into the future, when hopefully in the not too distant future, this whole COVID situation will be over. So what are some hopes or perspectives that you have for the time after that?
I've got three children, so I'm focusing on them and what they're getting up to. My eldest is 16 and my youngest is 11. And, you know, I worry a lot about what they will be doing. And, you know, I think things are getting very competitive in academic senses and just in work sense. So I want to train them all up to be directors. I'm trying to go, I won't charge you any money. We can do it over a summer. It'll be great. But they're all like, nah. So, I don't know. I'm just worried about what they're going to get into, you know, the way the world is and the things that need doing. And I wish I could make documentaries because those are my favorite things. You know, that's the only way you change things. My life has been changed by, you know, so many fantastic documentaries that take you places that you would never normally go. You know, you get the sense that stories almost have run out, you know, whereas you get a documentary and it's about real things and real people and real passion. And there's something really intriguing about that. I'm just not clever enough to do documentaries. I like stories. So that's my lot. But I'm trying to help my kids. I think that's what I'm trying to do by continuing to work, but also hopefully feeding them ideas about, you know, becoming a director or a writer or something. Because there's, you know, there are huge opportunities for young people now, especially for girls, you know, especially for women. It's their time, you know, they've got to step up and you've got to provide roles. So two daughters of mine, we'll see where they end up.
Yeah, that sounds like a great plan too, and also combining your personal and your professional life in there. So lots of stuff to juggle. I'm sure you get to do a documentary someday. It's probably just all practice.
I don't want to do a documentary. It's too hard. It's kind of, you have to be brave and you have to go places that you get into trouble. You know, I'm a well-behaved working class boy. I can't, you know, wander into criminals and dictators compounds and get the gen.
But you've also you've mentioned that you almost studied animal psychology, so maybe yeah. Something in that
go back
direction.
To animal psychology? No, that'll shoot me. I might go back and play in my double bass. I got a double bass, so I might go back and start recording some music again if I ever retire. But I can't see it. I love my job. It's kind of the best thing ever.
That's wonderful. Also good to see that you haven't stopped during lockdown. That just came to my mind. I think that's a very prominent theme in your work and the way you approach things in general, that you mentioned your working class background and the thing that you had, that project that you rejected because you didn't care about the people. I think that's because it was some aristocratic family. I think class plays a lot of a big role in there, doesn't it?
I think if you grow up that way, people say you shouldn't talk about your background, but I think it's really important, because if there are working class kids who see my story, then what the fact that I was able to get from absolutely nothing to an international career, then they can look at it and think, why can't I do that? Because certainly if I can do it, anyone can do it. You know, if you're persistent and you know, honest with yourself and you work hard, you know, you can absolutely get there. It took me longer than most middle-class kids, because most middle-class kids can afford to work for nothing, you know, and just sort of wander in, wander out. Whereas, you know, I just didn't have a plan B. I said to myself, I'm not doing anything else. This is it. So that's been hard, you know. It's a hard graft, but everything I've achieved, I've done myself, which is a huge feeling of achievement for me. So I would just encourage people in a similar position to really graft and learn their stuff. There's that fantastic Bob Evans quote when he says, in this business, you make your own luck. And my definition of luck is when opportunity meets preparation. It's such a perfect, perfect nugget of, you know, you work, you learn, you get your craft together. And then out of nowhere, because you can't plan, out of nowhere comes an opportunity. And someone will say, can you do this? And you go, oh, yeah, yeah. And then you do it. And then you do something else. So it's like it's a life philosophy, really.
Das war unser Interview mit Philipp John. Und ja, wir haben auf jeden Fall ganz viel mitgenommen. Patrick, was fandest du denn am aufschlussreichsten gerade eben?
Mich war es auf jeden Fall super spannend zu hören, dass es anscheinend die Faustregel gibt, Film sei ein Regisseurmedium und Fernsehen ein Autorenmedium. Da Philipp ja Erfahrungen in Film und TV hat, war es wirklich interessant zu erfahren, wie die Hierarchien da aufgebaut sind. Und allgemein fand ich es auch sehr schön zu hören, wie er in seinem Job aufgeht. Wie bei unseren letzten Gästen ist Philipp ja auch wirklich persönlich im Gespräch geworden.
Ja, auf jeden Fall. Und so fand ich es auch total interessant und schön, wie er auch auf seinen Karriereweg so eingegangen ist. Eben so ganz bodenständig, wie er da auch praktischere Aspekte beim Regieführen so ein bisschen dargelegt hat, wie eben dieses Beschaffen eines Visums, wo man ja auch erstmal drauf kommen muss. Und ja, hat uns ja auch auf jeden Fall ganz viele nützliche Lebensweisheiten so ein bisschen an die Hand gegeben.
Ja, total. Und es war auch echt mal erfrischend zu hören, dass es auch so viele, eigentlich ist es selbstverständlich, aber dass es so viele praktische Dinge gibt, auf die man beim Regieführen Acht geben muss und auch solche Sachen, die einem vielleicht ganz gewöhnlich vorkommen, und dass er eben auch auf diese Sachen eingegangen ist, im Gegensatz zu den eher glamourösen oder künstlerischen Sachen, die man vielleicht zuerst mit dem Filmemachen verknüpfen würde. Und dementsprechend fand ich es auch sehr cool, wie er über sein Heimatland erzählt hat und dass es ihm wichtig war, Wales auch mal abseits der eher ländlichen Stereotypen darzustellen.
Ja, total. Und ich fand es eben auch cool, dass er überhaupt jemand ist, der Aufmerksamkeit auf Wales lenkt. Weil ich finde, das geht immer so ein bisschen unter.
Ja, absolut. Hoffentlich hat er Erfolg damit. Er scheint es ja wirklich zu versuchen mit seinen Filmen. Und vielleicht die überraschendste Info, die er mit uns geteilt hat, war wohl, dass es in einem seiner nächsten Filme auch darum gehen soll, diese Stereotypen zu durchbrechen. Und dass dieses Let There Be Rock, war ja der Titel, sein erster Pitch in Hollywood war, der ja wohl, sobald es wieder möglich ist, mit Anthony Hopkins in der Hauptrolle in Produktion gehen soll. Und ich meine, Verena, wir haben das ja beide gegoogelt und konnten dazu bisher sehr wenig finden. Also noch ein Exclusive in unserer Interviewreihe, den ihr hier zuerst gehört habt. Hurra!
Sehr cool. Und ja, wenn ihr das Interview mit Philipp John auch so cool und spannend fandet wie wir, dann haben wir jetzt noch eine gute Nachricht für euch. Das hat man jetzt gerade eben gar nicht mehr gehört am Ende. Aber er hat dann nach dem Interview auch nochmal definitives Interesse geäußert, dass er mal wieder bei Filmfestivals in der Region vorbeischauen will.
Und das war's dann mit unserer dreiteiligen Interviewreihe. Wir hoffen, es hat euch auch Spaß gemacht und dass ihr ein paar interessante Infos mitnehmen konntet. Danke euch vielmals fürs Zuhören, und das waren am Mikro Patrick
und Verena.